This is Gutcast. Life for Crohn's and colitis, also known as inflammatory bowel disease or IBD, is often a difficult journey. Getting diagnosed can be a particularly scary and overwhelming time. I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease in April 2019, and there was a world of information to take on at the time and ever since. For the first podcast in the series, we are looking at the general questions I and many others with IBD have when first diagnosed. To help answer some of these questions, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Anthony O'Connor, consultant gastroenterologist at Talla University Hospital. Anthony, thank you for joining me. When you first meet somebody who's been diagnosed with IBD, what's your first response to them?
I suppose one of the difficult things for doctors is, for us, diagnosing somebody with a life-altering condition is kind of what we do every day of the week. Mm. For the person on the other side hearing the news, it's life-altering.
Yeah.
And you have to balance that. I suppose maybe in days gone by, we possibly disclose things to people in a graded manner. We might tell them a little bit on the first visit, a little bit more in the second visit. But now information has been opened up so much that really we've got to be very upfront and give a big investment of time on day one when we diagnose somebody for the first time. At the same time, you still have to be conscious that you're not going to be scaring the living daylights out of somebody on day one when they're in a vulnerable and difficult place. So one of the things I might do when I'm delivering the news to somebody first is perhaps, you know, tell them a bit and then point them towards resources where they can get their own information that they can digest in their own time. Tell them, well, they can expect to see me again. Ask them to write down their questions, because particularly people who are hospitalized, you know, the thing I always hear all the time, when I always ask a patient, do you have any questions? And they'll say, I'll have 10 minutes time when you're gone.
Yeah.
So I always ask people, I always bring a little piece of paper to the patient's bedside for them to document certain things about how they're feeling day to day, and also to write their questions on it. And the following day we go over all of that, and it seems to work for most people.
What is IBD, and we're hearing an awful lot about IBD and IBS and all of these different terms now. Can you give me what's the difference between IBD and IBS for one, and then maybe a little bit more about exactly what IBD means?
Okay, so IBD stands for inflammatory bowel disease. IBS stands for irritable bowel syndrome. And perhaps at the start, it's best to maybe think about the things that are similar between the two conditions, and that'll help us understand the differences a bit better. So in both conditions, people can get lots of symptoms from their gut. They can have an alteration of their bowel habit. They can get pain and discomfort. They can be missing school, missing work. And both conditions can cause people a lot of problems in their life. Where they differ, inflammatory bowel disease, when we look at the lining of the gut, we tend to see ulcers, we tend to see inflammation, sometimes we can see narrowing, and so on and so forth. Irritable bowel syndrome, on the other hand, what I often say to patients is the plumbing is fine. There is no blockages, there is no ulcers, but the electricity is a little bit haywire.
Okay.
So, you know, they might be suffering symptoms like bloating and diarrhea and abdominal pain, similar to that patients with IBD can get, but for different reasons.
Yeah.
And that there isn't actually a sort of a physical blockage or ulcer or inflammation causing it.
Mm.
The main types of inflammatory bowel disease that we deal with are Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis.
Mm-hmm.
They're quite prevalent in Ireland. We estimate about 35,000 people in Ireland suffer with some form of inflammatory bowel disease.
Mm-hmm.
And that prevalence is rising and growing as we get better at picking it, at identifying it earlier, and trying to treat it.
Absolutely. When I was first diagnosed a few months ago, about a year prior, I was having symptoms. And I think that's quite common with people living with IBD. It's a long process, isn't it, to get diagnosed?
The average person goes about 9 months between the first time they ever have symptoms when they're actually definitively diagnosed with IBD. There's a number of reasons for that. Some of them are due to sort of unacceptable delays in our health service. Others are due to the fact that, you know, a lot of the symptoms at the beginning, you know, bloating, abdominal discomfort, people are busy, they're inclined to write it off. You know, maybe I've just eaten the wrong thing, or I need to change my diet or something like that. It's important to know this isn't just unique to Ireland. There was a study from Canada a few years ago that suggested some patients are waiting up to 9 years for a diagnosis. But it is a consistent frustration for people, and something I think we need to get better at.
Exactly. And even going back to the overlap between IBD and IBS, the symptoms I was having over a year ago were things like ulcers in my eyes and my mouth. I would never have associated with an IBD condition, but
obviously that was the start of it, especially because I think the stereotypical symptoms that can be associated with IBD, people don't realise that there's a long list. And once you've met one person with IBD, you've met one person with IBD, everybody has a different story.
It's as individual as your thumbprint, as I always say to people. And it's kind of unfortunate in some respects that the two diseases sound the same.
Yeah.
IBS, IBD, I mean, for a lay person, it's difficult to keep track of it.
Yeah.
One point that is important to make is if you look at the general population, about 15% of people have IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. Mm. If you look at the population of people who have inflammatory bowel disease, IBD, then about 40% of those have IBS as well. So you're about 2.5 more times likely to have IBS if you have IBD than if you don't have IBD. So it's not necessarily an either or. And sometimes the conditions can coexist together. And that presents us with a particular challenge.
Absolutely, a huge challenge. And what would be your top tip questions to ask during that time to get the answers that you're looking for?
I suppose it's a little bit different for a patient who's in hospital versus a patient who's an outpatient. And when somebody's in hospital, then it's very much a taking it day by day scenario. So a newly diagnosed patient in hospital might want to ask what their bloods are like on that given day. You know, if the doctors and nurses looking after them feel there's any possibility of requiring surgery. On the other hand, in an outpatient scenario, other questions might be a bit more relevant, like, am I going to need steroids? How long am I going to need to stay on steroids for? How long am I going to be off work? So it varies based on the presentation, but those would be good questions to start with.
Did you ever get the question of why me?
It's a difficult one. And one of the things that I find difficult is patients a lot of the time will say, oh, it must be something I've eaten. And oftentimes maybe their parents or their partner might say, oh, it's because you don't eat enough of this or because you eat too much of that. And people can get into this cycle of blaming themselves, which is all wrong. It's nothing to do with what you ate.
Yeah.
It's nothing to do with how you live your life. It's just something that you have been unlucky enough to have visited on you.
Yeah.
And that's really important that people don't dwell on that and be blaming themselves.
Mm, I do find that actually, now that you say it, that when I was firstly diagnosed and I was telling people, the first thing they jump to is, can you eat this? Can you eat that? And I know it's coming from a really good place, but it is, I suppose, we need to educate the wider public on that it's not diet related. The diet can have effect on it, I presume, though. Is that correct in saying?
Yeah, and I think most patients with IBD will identify their own trigger foods that they need to stay away from. Again, they're individual.
Yeah.
You know, what's right for you might not be right for somebody else and vice versa. But, you know, definitely we need to get out of the sort of cycle of blaming people for whatever diet they have or whatever, you know, lifestyle they lead.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like one of the questions is like, does this, like, what impact does this have on my life now?
So I've got about 2,500 people with IBD. So that gives you a really good overview of how things are. And the first thing I say to any young person diagnosed with IBD is all the great and wonderful things that were going to happen to you in your life are still going to happen. This disease is going to be there. And our job is to try and put it in the background of your life rather than the foreground of it. So that's really, really important. IBD isn't going to shorten your life.
Okay.
It's going to bring certain challenges with it. And if you look at a group of people diagnosed with IBD, 10 years later, just over half of them will have at least had at least one inpatient stay in hospital.
Okay.
Medications are going to be part of your life for an IBD patient, and surgery is going to be part of your life as an IBD patient for quite a lot of people.
Okay.
But it's a matter of keeping the patient and the team focused on the idea that the huge part of what we're doing is getting people to be able to live their lives the way they want, to travel when they want, to do whatever job they want, to do whatever hobbies they want. And I'll often spend a lot of time at a new diagnosis getting to know the person. What are they interested in? If their interest is running, you know, when they come back, I'll use that as an objective measure of success. Are you getting out for your runs?
Yeah.
Have you done any 10Ks recently? Things like that. Similarly, if somebody's career or academic life is very, very important to them, to use that. And you know, I think that's the best way forward.
How bad can it get?
So there are some very good resources to look into.
Okay.
The ISCC, and I would recommend to any IBD patient to get involved with the ISCC. You get great peer support. And we actually know as doctors, a patient does better if they're involved in a peer support program like the ISCC. Their website has got fantastic information. The British version, Crohn's and Colitis UK, they've got really fantastic information, which is also packaged for employers and teachers and things like that. So if you don't want to explain everything that's going on with your disease, you can print off IBD for employers and bring it in and give it to your boss or your co-workers or whatever.
Yeah.
To answer your question, how bad can it get? There's no getting away from it. A lot of people really, really suffer with this disease. On the other hand, there's probably never been a better time to have it. The drugs and the interventions that we have now are better for it than at any time that it's been before. And we're getting some signals through from the research that if you look at the long-term outlook for people with IBD, then it's improved significantly in the last 20 years. Now, obviously, that sort of data takes a long time to come to us because it involves following people up over decades rather than months or years. But, you know, the sort of top range medications now that we're using for IBD, we've been using them for about 20 years. So we're just starting to get this trickle in of data of people who've used these medications, and they seem to be doing a lot better than people who, let's say, in the era before we had these drugs. So the outlook is good.
Okay. And will I be on medication for the rest of my life?
Most IBD patients will be on medication for most of their lives.
Okay.
The medication that you're on will vary, and very few IBD patients will stay on the same prescription for life. There may be times where an IBD patient might need more medication or a stronger combination of medication, and there may be other times where they could de-escalate their medication or possibly get off medication altogether for a period. That's particularly relevant when people have surgery. Oftentimes, when people do have surgery, they get a couple of years off medication, which for some people is a really a real benefit of having surgery. But yeah, for most people, you'll be on some medication for most of your life.
Yeah. I suppose bringing it back to symptoms and that, you know, there's a lot of talk about, oh, you're currently in a flare, you're out of a flare, you may be in remission, all these kind of terms that I suppose I would be quite alien to prior to my diagnosis. What exactly does a flare mean, and how will I know I'm in a flare again?
Sure. So particularly with Crohn's disease, all the time, there's a little bit of disease activity bubbling away there the whole time. The patient may not always be aware of this because they might be feeling fine. They might have normal bowel movements. They might have no bleeding. They might have no pain, but the disease is still sort of bubbling away there in the background. What a flare is really is when the symptoms start to skyrocket.
Okay.
So somebody may be experiencing going to the bathroom a bit more often, might be bleeding, might be having pain, might be vomiting, might have weight loss, might be feeling very, very fatigued. So all of these things can be signs of a flare. So, you know, what a flare really means is when there's sort of objective evidence of the disease being active at that particular time over a sustained period. Now, look, even patients who don't have IBD, people will get days where they have a couple of days where they have a bit of diarrhea or bloating or something like that.
Yeah.
The patient who does have IBD then is in this sort of dilemma. Am I flaring or is this normal? And it's very, very difficult for people to be in. And that's
judge.
Why. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, your IBD nurse is a great resource in that setting. And everybody should have an IBD nurse.
Yeah.
There should be far more of them in all parts of the country.
Completely agree, yeah.
Yeah, to help people through those times. So some of the things we might do if we suspect you're having a flare, we might do some blood tests. We might do take a stool sample.
Okay.
You know, occasionally we might need to perform a scope test or possibly do a CAT scan or something like that, depending on the severity of it.
Yeah. But to some areas that don't have IBD nurses, where can they turn to, you know, around the country who are maybe listening into the podcast? Where can they go?
This is really, really difficult.
Yeah.
People have their general practitioners. General practitioners are marvelous. They do fantastic work, but you know, they've got to know a little about absolutely everything. And, and it may be difficult for them to give an IBD patient all the time that they need. You know, obviously there's your medical team in the hospital, there's your consultant gastroenterologist, but again, sometimes in these places, a gastroenterologist might have a lot of other roles as well as being an IBD doctor. I suppose where I work, that's my main role is being an IBD doctor, so I can devote a little bit more time to it. But I think what we need to focus on is having a situation where the reach of IBD nurses goes around the country. The ISCC does provide a good helpline as well, but obviously they can't give you individualised medical advice because it's just, you can't expect them to do that, and it wouldn't be right for them to do that. But I think what we need to do is focus on increasing the reach of IBD nursing and getting more IBD nurses and supporting them once they're in the role. Having them support one another and lifelong learning, things like that.
You had said earlier that there's no better time to have IBD. I know what you mean by it.
Yeah.
Will there ever be a cure, do you think, from your research, or is there talk about anything like that? Because it just seems to be going the opposite, that more and more people are developing it, which I presume will be putting more and more pressure on the health service, which, you know, is just going to create a circle going around. Are we ever going to see an end to IBD?
I think a nice thing would be if we figured out what exactly caused it. Yeah. And if we knew that, then we might be a little bit closer to a cure. Yeah. I'm an optimist, so I think, at some stage, I think we'll probably get to the bottom of it. And we're chipping away at it the whole time.
Yeah.
I mean, our focus in IBD really at the moment is to have it as a disease that we can control rather than cure. Mm. And I think for the good, clear majority of people now, it is a disease that can be controlled for the vast majority of the time. Yeah,
completely can agree with that, because, and I think speaking with a lot of people who are living with IBD, prior to diagnosis, as I say, they wouldn't have put certain symptoms down to IBD. Yeah. And it wasn't until that I was clearing an infection that I had developed that I realised, oh my God, these are linked. Yeah. And now I feel great. I have more energy. I, you know, feel a lot better even in putting clothes on. Feel so much better.
The fatigue is really hard.
The fatigue is really, really hard.
Joint pain, eye pain, rashes, things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. And you don't realise it, because there is such a big difference, I suppose, to fatigue and just tiredness.
Oh,
that
huge.
And again, something I didn't realise. I thought everybody felt the same as I did.
And then you get that boost when you're not feeling that way and you think, oh wow, this is how I'm supposed to feel. I was compared to when I was a kid, I got glasses for the first time. I was about 8. I remember putting them on in the shop, and I can still picture it. So this is what the world looks like. And I think sometimes it's like that for people who suffer with fatigue, that, you know, they don't realize what the fatigue is like until it's gone, you know?
Exactly. The way I can put it into context is before I went into hospital, my stomach was so swollen, and I used to refer to it as my pouch. And like anytime I was getting dressed, I'm like, oh, my pouch is showing. And I actually didn't realize that was swelling. And that was, I suppose, the start of it all. But a couple of days in hospital treating my pouch and my infection, I couldn't believe. I was like, my stomach is so much flatter. I can't get over this.
Bloating is huge, and it's real. You know, I remember sort of starting off as a doctor. I've been a doctor for 15 years now. Yeah. But even sort of starting off in gastroenterology, you'd hear people say, oh, you know, I eat some lettuce and it looks like I'm 9 months pregnant. And you're kind of thinking, how can that be the case?
Exactly.
Surely that can't be the case. Yeah. But actually, when I was in England, a consultant in Leeds in England for a few years, they did some research there where they invented this thing which basically measured how much people can bloat up and down by over the course of a day.
Oh, wow.
7 inches. Could you imagine 7 inches on your waist over the course of a day? That's with bad bloating. So it is real.
Yeah.
And if I had one message for anybody suffering with any GI complaint, gastroenterology complaint, IBS, IBD, anything, what you're experiencing is real.
Okay, good.
It's absolutely real and we can help.
What is the typical patient journey like?
For a lot of patients, it is similar to yours.
Okay.
Patients will get acutely unwell and sick and can't manage at home, and then they need to come into hospital. Being in hospital gives us the advantage of being able to get a lot of tests done very quickly and being able to get people on treatments very fast that will work very effectively. Another group of patients, let's say, mightn't be quite as sick when they're diagnosed. They might go to their general practitioner, who might just hear something he or she doesn't like about their history, or notice something in a blood test or on examination that makes them think that something requires further investigation. Mm. They'll write a referral letter to the hospital, and then, you know, you would come and see somebody like me either in an endoscopy unit or in an outpatient clinic, and we'd take it from there. So, you know, when patients are diagnosed with inflammatory bowel disease, for the most part, they're going to require steroids for a period. Okay. So we divide our treatment into what we call maintenance treatment, which are the drugs that we keep people on to keep them in remission. And then we've got treatments to get people into remission. And steroids are sort of the mainstay of that for a lot of the time. So in your case, you were probably treated with intravenous steroids, i.e. steroids given in through a drip. For patients who are outpatients, they might often be treated with tablet steroids. Okay. Hopefully we get things under control with the steroids within a couple of days, and then maybe transition people on, start taking away some of the steroid medications and start trying to introduce some other medications to keep people well. Mm-hmm. So the average patient might be in hospital, like yourself, for sort of 7 to 10 days when they're first diagnosed. And we let people go home then when they're getting better. Mm-hmm. And we usually sort of follow people up pretty quickly after their discharge, maybe after about 4 weeks, to see how they're getting on. Mm. where it leads on to from there on really depends on the disease itself. The first year with IBD is really difficult to predict. And for a lot of people, year one can be the worst because they're, you know, psychologically, you're getting your head around a really life-changing experience, but also physically, it's when the disease is at its most unpredictable because we don't know anything about it. We're trying to tame this disease, tame this beast that we don't really understand or know an awful lot about yet. So the first year can be difficult. There can be chopping and changing of medications. People can get frustrated because oftentimes we will start off with more basic medications and then increase in sophistication as time goes on. Now, some patients will be the opposite. If we see features that make us worry, we'll give them, let's say, the strongest medications from day one because we know that's the right thing to do. So year one can be very, very difficult. But what we aim to do is get you to a point where, you know, you're on a medication that's keeping things under control. You're coming in to see us once or twice a year for a chat and some blood tests and, you know, maybe a scope or a scan every couple of years. Depending on the individual type of disease that you have.
And there's so many questions around operating because it was, you know, something that did come up during my stint in hospital that a surgeon did come up and talk to me. So is that something that we're going to see?
So there's a bit of a difference between ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease in terms of surgery. And insofar as it relates to the patient, that's one of the biggest differences between UC and Crohn's. With ulcerative colitis, about one in four people roughly will have surgery, but the surgery is essentially a cure because ulcerative colitis is limited to the colon. So if you remove somebody's colon, they haven't got colitis anymore because you need a colon to have colitis.
Okay.
On the other hand, people can have other problems after surgery, like let's say a stoma, or sometimes people can have a procedure called a pouch procedure where we make a new rectum for them out of their small bowel, and sometimes that can lead to complications as well. So about one in four people with ulcerative colitis will have surgery. If you've got Crohn's disease, on the other hand, at least two-thirds of people with Crohn's disease will have an operation at some point in their life.
Okay.
This is something I feel very strongly about. I introduced that idea to people early, and I introduced that concept to people early. Mm. Surgery is just another way of managing this disease.
Okay.
Obviously, it brings with it a lot of scary things, a lot of scary conversations, but it is part of the management of the condition. Where I have seen things go badly wrong for patients over the years is when we don't talk about surgery early enough. We let things get to a point where things are getting worse and worse and worse. And then all of a sudden we're in a sort of an emergency situation a year into the diagnosis. And all of a sudden a big surgeon in scrubs with a mask and a scalpel is stood at the end of the bed saying, time for your operation.
Yeah.
and that's a bit too much. So I introduce the ideas about surgery early and say, look, I work as part of a team. My surgical colleague is another part of that team. You don't need his or her services at the moment, but here they are, and you may. And then what happens is if a patient gets to an unfortunate situation where they're not doing so well and surgery might be on the cards, they know who the surgeon is. They know who the stoma nurse is. They know a little bit about stomas should that come into play.
Yeah.
So that's something that I feel quite strongly about, that, you know, the surgeon is an integral part of the team and that patient should know that.
Absolutely. Yeah. You mentioned stoma bags there. It's huge concern for people who potentially might have them, who currently have them, about knowledge. What can you tell me, as someone who doesn't have one, what exactly is a stoma bag? Why would I have to have one potentially?
Okay, so what happens with a stoma is rather than using your rectum or your anus to pass stool as you normally would, you have an operation where we make an opening in the skin and bring a loop of your bowel out to the surface. And what would normally be coming out of your back passage now drains into a bag that you have sitting on the outside of your body. There are two main types of stomas that we use. There's a colostomy, and that's where we bring a loop of your large bowel out to the surface. And then there's an ileostomy, where we bring a loop of your small bowel out to the surface. So colostomies, we would generally use them for people who've got bad Crohn's disease around the bottom, what we call perianal Crohn's disease. And that's basically just to give the rectum and the anus a bit of a chance to heal by not having stool passing over them, you know, a couple of times a day. The other type of surgery where we would do ileostomies, that would often be in a situation, let's say somebody who had really bad ulcerative colitis who had to have their bowel removed. Or it might be a case somebody's got bad Crohn's disease where we have to cut out a segment of bowel. Somebody might be left with a stoma for a while with a view then to being rejoined at some point in the future. I think it's a decision that's different for people depending on what's going on in their life at the time. You know, fertility might enter into it as to whether or not somebody wants to have to be rejoined. One thing I would say, though, and this is consistent, I would say 85, 90% of my patients who I send for surgery and who end up with stomas would say, this is nowhere near as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Okay.
And I have had patients in my care in the past who've been professional sports people who've had stomas in place. I have work colleagues with stomas in place that I had no idea about, you know, and oftentimes the person themselves, it feels very, very conscious about it, but a lot of time to people outside, they've got no idea somebody's got a stoma. So it is a big psychological thing.
Yeah,
I think in a lot of hospitals, there are very good stoma nurses who are used to working both with patients with inflammatory bowel disease and cancer and a number of conditions, and they can be a real help to people. But, you know, my sort of philosophy on it is start the conversation about these things early.
Yeah.
Hope that you never arrive at that point. But if you do, a patient is informed and has their eyes open.
Yeah.
And some patients who have surgery won't require a stoma. And this would be particularly common for somebody, let's say, who had Crohn's disease that wasn't acutely unwell, but it was bubbling away all the time and not quite coming under control with medications.
Yeah.
In those patients, an operation is a fantastic option. You cut out the diseased part of bowel, join two healthy bits of bowel together, and it's almost like doing control alt delete on your computer, you know, and then you monitor going forward for disease to try and stop the disease coming back.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, the sicker somebody is when they have surgery, that enters into it too, as to how difficult a time they're going to have after the surgery and how extensive the surgery is going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. You touched on fertility there briefly, and that was, I think, the first question I asked when I was diagnosed. Does it affect fertility?
It has an effect. But again, it goes back to the thing I always say to my new patients with IBD. All the great things that are going to happen to you are still going to happen to you. We just have to help you plot a way around it.
Okay.
And nowhere is that more true than the area of fertility and pregnancy. I suppose the issue that a lot of women, couples, I suppose I should really say, have is people are worried about getting pregnant on medications. People, you know, but I always say the biggest barrier to getting pregnant is being unwell. So when you're really sick with Crohn's and run down nutritionally, your body's depleted, your periods are often going to be doing funny things. So get the disease under control first.
Okay.
If somebody's been well for a long time and wants to get pregnant, you could have a conversation about coming off some of the medications.
Okay.
But a lot of the time, you know, when a patient is doing well, we pilot lots of women through successful pregnancies. And, you know, particularly here in Dublin, there are very well established links between the maternity hospitals and the doctors that treat inflammatory bowel disease. And at least once a year, we have a meeting where we discuss these issues. The two things that we mainly want to avoid during a pregnancy are having to give you steroids and having to do an operation.
Yeah.
If we could avoid both of those things, that's great. Sometimes we can't avoid them, and that's why it's good to be linked in with a very specialist centre that can get you through these things. Obviously, again, this is where communication is all important. Stay in touch with your IBD nurses, stay in touch with your obstetrician, stay in touch with your gastroenterologist. And I can't stress enough, I'll have my IBD clinic on Wednesday afternoon, and I'll see 10 or 12 patients, and I'll see at least two buggies rolling in every week, I'd say. And that's, for me, that's one of the nicest parts of the job.
Yeah.
And you even get to see the kids grow, which is great.
Oh, great. And going back, I suppose, to labour, is a natural labour still possible? Just the stress that you're going to be putting your body under at that point, is that out of the question now for someone, or
no,
does it affect it at all?
Absolutely not out of the question. So, I mean, you know, back in the day, I suppose maybe an awful lot of women would have had cesareans who had inflammatory bowel disease. But now, even women who've had previous surgery, and they're a special group in terms of fertility and risks of pregnancy, women who've had previous surgery, and they may require extra counselling.
Yeah.
But even women who've had previous surgeries now are often having, you know, very successful vaginal deliveries in good high volume centres where there's good multidisciplinary care.
Okay.
So again, you know, the whole reason for being for a lot of us IBD doctors is to have this disease be as unobtrusive in your life as possible. Mm-hmm. And if supporting, let's say, a vaginal delivery and breastfeeding is part of that, then we've got to find ways to do that insofar as is possible and insofar as is safe.
Yeah.
Again, all patients, just ask your teams.
Yeah.
You know, ask your teams, get answers. Yeah. You know, go to reputable websites like the ISCC, Crohn's and Colitis UK, the CCFA in America, and get the information you need and, you know, help you get on with your life.
Absolutely. Well, look, it's been a pleasure. And I thank you so much for all of your knowledge and the way that you told us all of the information today. Yeah. Thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you.
You have been listening to Gutcast. Wherever you get your podcasts, don't forget to subscribe, rate and share. On the next episode, your mental health. The views, information or opinions expressed during the Gutcast series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not represent those of the Irish Society for Colitis and Crohn's Disease or Janssen Sciences Ireland. The primary purpose of this podcast series is to educate and inform and is not a substitute for professional diagnosis or treatment. This podcast is supported by funding from Janssen Sciences Ireland. Participants have been reimbursed for their time.